Okay, I think we're ready to begin. Let's begin with a word of prayer once again. Father in heaven, we thank you again for this opportunity that we can come together, and that we ask now that you'll open our hearts and minds to hear any messages you would have for us today in ways that we can improve our health and serve you better. We thank you for the sunshine that is brightly shining today and that we're all enjoying the beautiful warmth of it. Thank you for the friendships we have created. Thank you for the Sabbath that's soon coming upon us. Just be with us now and help us again to experience what you'd have us to experience during this class. We pray this in your name. Amen. Okay, so this is the last class, and I have lots to pack in for you. In fact, you know how these classes go. If you've ever prepared one, you kind of panic and wonder if you're going to have enough. So you keep adding more and more and more. And here we are on Friday, and I've got halfway. So we didn't run out, that's for sure. I try through, as being health director for the conference, I'm always trying to let people know of upcoming seminars and other health-related things that are happening. And hopefully, through your church, the secretary or bulletin person will be getting what we call FYIs from the conference of updated things that are happening. And a couple of them, I think I mentioned, did I mention to this class about the Women's Health Retreat weekend coming up? The last weekend of October in Calgary and the first weekend in November in Edmonton will be a Women's Health Retreat that we are doing. And also, some of you have heard of the Health Summit from the NAD, coming down with the North American Division Health Summit. It's in Orlando, Florida once again, starting in January. This is a place that you would go and get trained in all the various different workshops. If you want to do the depression seminars with Neil Nedley, if you want to do a CHIP program of Dr. Hans Deal, that type of thing. I have two posters here. Usually we do get these out to the churches to put up in the churches. Unfortunately, I don't know what happens between the time that we mail them out and getting them up in the churches. These things never seem to get handed out and posters up. So watch for them, and if you can help do that in your church, that's appreciated. I have a couple other posters, so if anyone wants to take these with them to advertise in their church, this is what we call Let's Move Day. Have any of you heard of Let's Move Day in Alberta? Okay, so there's a couple of you. But just the same, we're trying to get the word out on this. And this date this year is September 22. It is a Sunday. And it's basically a date that everyone gets involved across Canada and the U.S., again coming from the North American Division, getting people to host a 5K run or walk and do it as a community outreach event. It can be a lot of fun. Take some pictures. There is a website that you would actually register your church on and record the miles, and then they put all these miles together to see how many we can do and if we can surpass what we did last time. I'm trying to see. I had read how many miles they hope to do, but I don't see it on here again on this handout. But there is a website if you want to go to it for more information or to register your church. It's the www.AdventistInStepForLife.org. And so again, we're trying to just get all the churches involved in this, and especially if you're the health ministry director, maybe we can get something like this going in your church as a community event. The NAD meetings are January 24 to February 2, and it's Orlando, Florida. And I know that if you register early, you get a bit of a discount. The website for that is NADHealthSummit.com. NADHealthSummit.com. So there are two of each poster. If you want to take these to your church, you're welcome to take them. Okay, we will move forward here. Today, I know a number of you have asked about GMO. That question keeps coming up and different people commenting about it. So I wanted to address it. Most of my talks, I don't get into GMO and I don't get into organics and this type of thing because I don't want to overwhelm people with it. So far all week I've been trying to teach you to eat lots of fruits and lots of vegetables, and so now I don't want to turn it around and discourage you that you don't want to eat any, right? But I am going to tell you a little bit about it because I think we can make some wise choices and still, you know, be able to avoid some of these situations. So the first thing is, my food, is it genetically modified? Well, the term GM foods or GMOs, which is genetically modified organisms, is most commonly used to refer to crop plants created for human or animal consumption using the latest molecular biology techniques. So, these plants have basically been modified in the laboratory to enhance desired traits such as an increased resistance to herbicides or improved nutritional content. So does that sound good to you? Definitely. The whole purpose of it in the beginning was a very positive thing. The thing that does not work so well anymore is the fact it says not only can genes be transferred from one plant to another, but genes from non-plant organisms can also be used. And this is where the issue started coming in, because now these other organisms were starting to be induced into these plants and causing some problems. So, you know, you may have seen some of these pictures that go along with it of a tomato with a human embryo or something in the middle of it, because they can actually use human embryos and implant it to use in making these vegetables better, supposedly, right? So here we are, genetic engineering benefits, and there's a number of good benefits to it. Pest resistant crops, herbicide resistance, disease resistance, and so forth, so forth. You know, when it came down here to drought tolerance, you know, there was areas that people were starving to death, and there was so much drought they couldn't grow anything. So here they were able to use some of these seeds and plant crops to grow in the worst conditions. And so again, very positive thoughts into it. But along with the pros, we simply can't ignore the cons to this new technology. And we know there are over 50 studies done that link GMO foods to anywhere from allergy-related deaths to even cancer and other diseases. So now it's a problem, right? So organisms that have been created through the gene splicing techniques of this technology called GE, genetic engineering, this relatively new science allows the DNA of one species to be injected into another in a lab, creating combinations of plant, animal, bacteria, and viral genes that do not occur in nature or through traditional crossbreeding methods. They actually have to force this plant to accept it, and the best way is through virus or bacteria, and so E. coli is the easiest source for them to use to make the plants use it. So they'll use E. coli as the base to promote or to get this plant to accept these genes. So therefore, the jury is still out on all the known causes about how these GMOs will negatively affect the greater human race, and we may not really know for a few years yet to come. We will be seeing, we're already seeing some circumstances happening, but with time it's only then we're going to really see, and I just have a feeling it's not going to be too positive, which is sad. So it would be best to avoid them if possible, when possible, knowing the long-term health risks of ingesting these foods on a regular basis. So one of the foods that I've come to change in my diet, I will tell you, I am not 100% non-GMO and organic. Okay, I kind of eat what I can in season and pick and choose which things are the larger concern that I try to do. So don't see me as this total organic, you know, whatever you want to call it. I totally understand. I mean, if you can go 100% organic, that is excellent. And I do hope to eventually maybe get that direction. But I do understand costs, and I do understand what's available, and so forth. The point is, pick and choose what's more so and less of importance. And corn has become a huge issue. And so corn, we know, has been genetically modified, some say for at least 50 years, but we are really seeing the effects in the last 5 years or so about corn. And I've seen a number of people with serious allergies due to corn and different reactions. I don't know if you've ever seen this movie called King Corn. These are a couple of guys that were out of college and decided they wanted to research this and literally went on the road and grew their own crops of corn and learned all about it. Really interesting. You can sometimes get this out of your library and watch it even. But how many of you have heard about the corn crops being burned right now in Europe? Have any of you heard that? No, okay. They're burning a number of crops in Europe, corn, and just recently they started burning them in Oregon as well now. And that's closer to home, isn't it? So why are they burning these corn crops? Well, originally the corn was modified or changed to feed livestock, more or less, but it has just kind of gotten out of hand to a point that this is what humans are eating as well, this genetically modified corn now. And so here they were feeding them to their pigs. This corn was being grown and fed to the pigs. Now, do you understand the pig system? One of the reasons the main reason we're not to eat pig or pork is because it's very unclean. It has a way that if they were to eat a venomous snake, their tissue would actually absorb the venom and not make them sick. Let me tell you, the corn they are feeding the pigs is killing the pigs. So they've turned around and started burning all the crops now. So if this has an effect on a pig, the corn, and a venomous snake does not, doesn't that tell us something? So to me, red flags, corn is out for me, and I go with organic corn. And I'll tell you, health-wise, I have noticed a difference. I used to have this terrible cough that I was told was stress-related, and I would cough and cough and cough, especially at night, and I learned it was corn. And as soon as I switched over to organic corn, it's made a world of difference for me. So, you know, kind of, again, that's kind of top of my list to watch out for is corn. I am told if it's certified organic, it's non-GMO. This is what I've recently been told through the research, yes. If it just says organic and not certified organic, if you don't know or trust the source, then it could be GMO. But in most cases, people who do organic don't want to fool around with GMO to begin with, but you never know. So this scientist who did some research in the institution in the UK, he announced that his experiments with rats had shown intestinal changes, otherwise stunting their growth and affecting their immune system by eating genetically engineered potatoes. So this man, again, because of his findings, he refused to eat potatoes and anything that was modified, and he started to discourage its use, and unfortunately, he was fired from his job for doing so, of course. You know, one other thing, corn has become to a point that it has become a pesticide itself. You can take corn, grind it up, and put it on your garden to protect it from the insects. So it's come to that point, which is pretty serious. Now, not everything is GMO, and sometimes we get on this bandwagon and we say, GMO, 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 right? So I don't want you to do that either. I want you to look at it scientifically and decide what is and what truly isn't. And one of the things that I hear a lot of people say, and I myself used to question it, was seedless watermelon as being GMO. But we know it's actually not genetically modified, as some might assume. They are known as being a hybrid. And so what this means is, again, breeders match the pollen from one plant that has, it's a diploid plant of 22 chromosomes, and then they go and they the flower of a tetraploid plant, which contains 44 chromosomes, they put this together and we end up with one that's 33. And because of this, it's incapable of producing seeds. So this is what you would call a hybrid. So is it a problem? I don't think it's a problem. There's nothing that at this point is going to damage your body in any way at this point, right? The tiny white ones you sometimes find, those are seed coatings where a seed did not mature. So, you know, you can rest assured at least if you're eating a seedless watermelon that it's non-GMO. But, you know, if you like the way it first began with the big, long oval watermelon with the seeds, many people say they are sweeter. And so this is true, depending on the type. The same as you have, you know, different types of tomatoes can taste different or different these or that's makes a difference. So the watermelons do taste different. So, but it's up to you which one you enjoy, and it's not GMO, just so you know. You know, as I started to research, I started to see, okay, well, which ones, for example, that scientist, he had talked about genetically modified potatoes. And so starting to research a little bit, potatoes, the russet potatoes, are your biggest risk for GMO, and then all the other ones are less risk or no risk. Red potatoes is something I've always promoted in general, just because if someone has arthritis, the russet potatoes tend to aggravate people's joints with stiffness and pain, whereas the red potatoes do not. But, you know, there's Yukon Gold, there's other choices as well. When it comes to tomatoes, it's my understanding that your Roma tomatoes are your safest, although sometimes I question because those are getting pretty big too. But I am told that the Romas have not been played around with in the way of GMO. You know, for example, how many of you did you ever watch the Access News channel from Edmonton where they would kind of have different people and they would bounce around interviewing different ones? Well, I was doing a cooking thing once for them. This is probably already 10 years ago. And so I did my little thing and then they bounced off me to someone else while I was preparing for the next shot. And just kind of listening, you know, I was doing my thing and all of a sudden I heard this lady say to the person interviewing her, well, what do you see here? And she says, a tomato. And she says, okay, and what else? She says, well, nothing. And she says, well, what if I told you that was 50% pig? And the lady says, what? And that was the first time I was kind of introduced to it, that this big hothouse tomato she held, she was saying how the pig enzymes were, you know, genetically put into these tomatoes to make them grow bigger, to last longer, to be more red, and so forth. Now, I understand some of these tomatoes continued and some didn't because people weren't happy. Some are too juicy, some are too meaty, and so, you know, they're always playing with it, trying to make it so that we're happy with that perfect tomato. But tomatoes, again, I like to promote yellow tomatoes because yellow tomatoes are not as acidy as red tomatoes. So again, people with arthritis can enjoy yellow tomatoes without the same headaches they get with, you know, pain and such with the red tomatoes. And if you go to a grocery store and buy yellow tomatoes, they're usually at least 3 times the price, aren't they? But they're just as easy to grow as any other tomato. So grow some yellow tomatoes. You know, for me, we have a greenhouse my husband made now, and it is full of tomatoes, full of yellow tomatoes. I grow tons of yellow tomatoes. And I even had fun last year making homemade salsa from my yellow tomatoes. My kids would give me a hard time. They would say, Mom, this is just wrong. Yellow salsa is just wrong. And it ended up being just something so unique that people liked it, and it was gone in no time. So this year we will enjoy making lots of yellow salsa. So how do we know what is and isn't GMO and organic and this type of thing? Well, you see these little stickers here. They're not going to advertise. They don't want to put on their signs GMO growing tomatoes because who's going to turn around and grab them? So they will refuse to do that. However, you can tell by your produce stickers what they are. And so the first one is conventionally grown, and it has 4 numbers on it, so such as 1033, or here you see 4030. It doesn't matter what those numbers are. If there's 4 numbers, it means it's been conventionally grown. And my understanding, this is the same for US and Canada. Okay, now organic has actually 5 numbers on the sticker, as you can see here, and it always begins with a 9. So that's how you know if it's organic. So 5 numbers and begins with a 9. And the last one is if it's genetically modified. It has 5 numbers, just like the organic does, because it's not conventional, so it has 5 numbers. But this one begins with an 8. So anything that's 5 numbers begins with an 8 is supposed to be GMO. Oh, companies have the option of this now. Okay. I understood that they had to follow this for coding, but okay, she's saying that she understands companies have the option now whether to do this or not. And I'm sure because this pattern now has been put out there that we're starting to share, so yes. Okay, good one. So if it's not on the fruit, it's on the sign on the longer barcode and it's at the end, right? Oh, it's a separate number. Okay. She was saying if the sticker isn't on your actual fruit, it could be on the store sign with the price where it has the code number and then it has separate that 4 or 5 digit number on the sign as well. So just to review again, conventional has 4 numbers. Doesn't matter what numbers they are, right? Organic starts with a 9 and has 5 numbers. And GMO has 5 numbers and starts with an 8. So again, you know what? We just do the best we can do. And that's the way it goes. I mean, we're going to hit walls every so often on this earth, and one thing we have to look forward to is a new earth where there will be the tree of life and a different produce, a different fruit every month, and we don't have to worry about barcodes and GMO and organic and all the above, and I'm sure that the flavors we enjoy today will not even come close to what we will enjoy then. All right. Factors, I'm going to be skipping through some of these slides because I don't have time to do them all. I want to hit on certain things with you today. But factors causing the majority of deaths, just as a review again, what are they? The diet, poor diet, inadequate exercise, and other lifestyle factors. Can you control those three things?
Yes.
So in knowing that, the majority of deaths can be controlled. That's a very promising thing, isn't it? All right. And then, of course, you know about the 8 laws of health. Once again, this is like a puzzle, and if one of these pieces are missing, the puzzle is never complete. So they're not here for you to pick and choose and decide what works well for your life. The whole thing is a package deal to give you optimal health. Heart disease, once again, I've covered a fair bit of that as I've gone through the week, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I just want you to notice, again, the factors that contribute to heart disease. Some people will say to me, well, you know what, I have high blood pressure, but my cholesterol is good, so therefore I shouldn't have heart disease, should I? Well, these are factors. It doesn't mean that you have to have them all to have heart disease. These are all different factors that can lead to heart disease. And so you do want to do as much as you can to take care of it. Now, a lot of times people don't worry about it until they actually have heart disease. But in a sad situation, the first sign of a heart problem in 50% of all cases is instant death. So if we're going to wait to have symptoms of a heart disease, that's it, right? If you're in that first 50 percentile. We had a man when we used to do the CHIP program who would come and do he was a phlebotomist, and he would come and do our blood draw before, at the beginning of our class and at the end of our CHIP program. And he was an Adventist man, and he was in excellent shape, and he's full of energy and looked good and all the above. But he would get excited about our program, especially because he drew the blood and saw the before and the after effects. And he would say to my husband and I, oh, I've got to attend this CHIP program. I just got to do it. But my life is so busy and I've got so much going, but I'll do it one of these days. Well, after he did a few programs with us, he actually went on a Pathfinder trip to Oshkosh, and he drove down, and when he got out of the car, within a few minutes he collapsed and he died instantly of a heart attack. And so he thought he was okay, right? And the point is, don't put it off. Don't wait until you have issues. Now, I found out he already knew he had some issues with high blood pressure or high cholesterol, this type of thing. But he wasn't diagnosed with a heart problem at this point. So these are all factors. Pay attention to them all. One, you know, it's not going to, you'd want to pay attention. Even if stress is your only thing here, you've seen how much stress can damage the body in all sorts of areas. So don't put it off. Try to do what it takes to reverse some of these. Now, this is the other thing I want to talk about, because you very rarely hear about the term homocysteine. And homocysteine is quite an interesting thing. Homocysteine, I shared with you when we were on the first day of A for amino acids. I mentioned to you there was 20 amino acids that help build proteins. Well, homocysteine is one of those 20 different amino acids that the body will use to make these proteins, as well as carry out other chemical processes in the cells. However, individuals with high homocysteine, where they get too much homocysteine caught in their blood, they are twice likely to have clogged arteries. And so either they're getting too much homocysteine in their diet in some way, or it is that they lack in folic acid, B6 and B12. These three things get rid of the homocysteine in your bloodstream that you do not need. And so what happens is it'll take it then and convert it to another amino acid called methionine. And this one here, of course, is not an issue, but the homocysteine is. So now, particularly when it comes to people who are vegan, the question is, why are some of these people who are now no meat, no dairy, this type of thing, what is the issue? Why is it that they suddenly need a stent or they have a heart attack and this problem? We are finding that it is contributed to this homocysteine levels. The homocysteine is too high, it's going to induce a heart issue. And so we need to get that homocysteine out of the bloodstream. So the best way to know what your level is to ask your doctor to do a homocysteine test. When you have your blood tested, ask if your homocysteine can be tested. Now, unfortunately, they don't relate homocysteine to a heart condition. And so most cases, they'll say, no, we don't do that, and it's just a waste of money and, you know, sort of thing. So hopefully your doctor will be willing to do that for you and see where you're at. And I believe the number should be 7 or less is where you want to be with your homocysteine levels. This came really to light for me because I've experienced this personally myself. I did a little bit of, I was down at Uchi Pines with my students from my school. We go there once a year kind of thing for those who want more of the practical work. And while there, my students, you know, we put them through the blood work and this type of thing. And I decided I wanted it too because I wasn't really seeing a doctor regularly after moving. And I was kind of draggy and tired and assuming it was my iron, which my doctor was always telling me that my iron was an issue. And she'd also mentioned that my B12 was excellent, so I was never concerned about B12. Well, anyways, talking with Dr. Thrash, we were chatting, and there's one of the tests you can have done as well, which quite often the doctors will do, will test you to what risk you are for heart disease. Well, mine was so low it didn't even register, so that was fine. I didn't think much of that. And my iron, I was concerned about, and I looked at it, and according to Dr. Thrash, my iron level was perfect. It was just on the low side, but it wasn't really low. And it was explained that we as vegans, if you're not consuming animal products and such, your iron will be slightly lower, as long as it's not in a low dangerous zone, but it can be slightly lower, and this will actually protect you against heart disease as well. Because the type of iron that's found in animal meat will push your iron up, but it's a type of iron that can also increase your risk of heart disease. And so I said, well, then why am I so tired all the time? So as we were looking through my blood work, we noticed my red blood cell count was a little bit low for some strange reason. And then came my homocysteine levels, and I was 10. So you're supposed to be 7 or less, and I was 10. And she said to me, if you're under any stress, you could have an instant heart attack. So here I am, I'm at zero risk over here, but I'm a high risk over here because my homocysteine levels were so high. So what was the concern? My B12 shows normal and perfect, and I would never have known if that was not tested. So you need the combination. Just because I was good in B12, I knew personally, just from being a nutritionist, I knew I was low in B6, but I wasn't jumping up and down to make a big deal about it. And because I was low in this combination was not good enough to get rid of my homocysteine levels. So by taking a combination of folic acid, B6 and B12, I was able to lower my numbers, and it's down to 5 now, just by taking that one little supplement. So if you are lacking in B6 or lacking in B12, you may wish to take this as an actual combination. If your doctor doesn't want to test your homocysteine levels, you could also ask what your red blood cell count is. Because if it is low, then you know that's the risk, because this helps produce red blood cells. And so this will raise that number as well by taking your folic acid B6 and B12. So I'm trying to get this message out a little bit more just because this is starting to become more of an issue with people who are more vegan. That's right. His question was, when a doctor tells you, you know, how do you know to trust when they say, oh, you're okay in here and okay in there? You know, you have the right to ask for a copy of your blood work. And so I encourage everybody, when you have blood work done, ask for a copy of it. Legally, they have to give that to you. And people are asking for this now, so it's becoming more common. So you will get an official copy, and on there it'll even tell you what levels you need to be between, and then you can see for yourself if you're low or you're high. And then, you know, sometimes that's where it comes in handy to know somebody who can help you with that as well. I don't have that number offhand, but again, on your lab sheet, it'll show what, and again, if the doctors, it was never a concern for me, you know, according to the doctor. So again, you can ask them, even if you don't get a copy, say, well, what range should it be in, and what am I? And that can help you. Okay, this man just has the perfect testimony to go with this. He's a CHIP director. He follows the entire CHIP lifestyle diet, and his cholesterol was 1.9. which is very low, and he had a heart attack in 2012, and his homocysteine 11, and his homocysteine levels were 12. So he didn't know until that happened, and then he had his homocysteine level told. So it's exactly, we're starting to see some of this happen. And any other questions on that? Okay, let's move on to hypertension now. So hypertension, high blood pressure otherwise, again, we've talked a little bit about this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but just want to touch on it again. If you are normal range is top number between 120 and 129, bottom number between 80 and 84. That's normal. If you are under that, we call it optimal. To be lower is excellent. Now, if you have low blood pressure, this is not a problem unless it's bothering you. If you start to get dizzy and lightheaded and blacking out, of course that's a problem, right? And so what are the two things you can do to help raise your blood pressure? Exercise and water. Especially if you are low blood pressure, you will dehydrate very easily. So keep up your water, and exercise will help for low blood pressure. If you're going to do the salt thing, like usually medically they'll tell you to take some salt, that is not ideal, because then it's going to cause other problems. So you really just want to raise it in a natural way of exercise and water. Now, the other thing, if you find your blood pressure is really low and just causing all sorts of problems, look for food sensitivities. See if what you eat at one meal drops your blood pressure. Because people who tend to have really low blood pressure tend to have food sensitivities. It's the way their body reacts to what they just ate. So if you find you ate a meal and within an hour you're just feeling kind of, huh, and you can tell your blood pressure is crashing and you can tell your pulse is racing, think about what you ate at that meal. And the next time it happens, see if there's a pattern happening, because that is very common as well. So being in the normal range, of course, is good. Low means that you have less risk of ever having high blood pressure, so that's a good thing. Now, high normal, sometimes you can get away with that without medication, but you've got to do something about it, because if you don't, it's just going to keep going up. And of course, this is the high risk, the greater risk above those numbers. These are the complications that can go along with hypertension, and surprisingly, any part of your body can be affected by this, of course. But these are your more common. So I'm sorry this picture is not coming out clear at all. But basically it is saying that hypertensive subjects have 10 times the incidence of white, it should say, matter lesions. Which means in the actual brain, you have these white matter lesions where there's no blood flow. Otherwise, these are areas of the brain that are not being used. And high blood pressure will cause these white matter lesions. And of course, our overall brain ability and intelligence is less because you're not using that portion of the brain. Now, this is interesting. Let's say you take medication and you're controlling your blood pressure now, right? We have found that the lesions are present no matter how well your blood pressure is treated with medication. So your blood pressure is taken care of by the medication, but these white matter lesions on the brain are not, and they will continue. It's still affecting the body even though you're controlling it with medication. Isn't that interesting? So the ideal way, of course, is to lower that using diet and lifestyle if you can. Now, I'm not telling you to go home and stop your medication, so please make sure you hear me on that, because you'll do more damage than good if you go home and suddenly stop your medication. You have high blood pressure that could just put you into a sudden heart attack or stroke or something, and we don't want that happening. The key is that you start to make diet and lifestyle changes. Tell your doctor you're doing this and ask him to monitor you and slowly decrease your medication if possible as you make those changes. You know, there was this conversation with this doctor once, and asking him, why is it that you don't promote more diet and lifestyle? Why always the medication for the blood pressure? And he said, well, because it doesn't work. And I said, well, how can you say it doesn't work when scientifically it's shown it works? And he says, no, I know scientifically it works. The issue is the people don't work. He said, after listening to you for 2 weeks, they're all excited and they come in and I'm going to do this. So if he were to pull them off the medication, 2 months from now, you've gone back to your diet and lifestyle the way you were, but you haven't gone back to your medication, and you suddenly have a stroke. And you know what? He's 100% correct. You have to make that choice, and you have to stick with it. So a lot of times we blame our doctors that they're always into prescribing. But in reality, isn't that what we want? You know, you go and you see a doctor, and if you don't walk out with a white piece of paper, what do we say? He did nothing for me. What was the point of even going there, right? So then you go and get a second opinion until someone finally gives you that white piece of paper. So, you know, we turn around and we kind of ridicule these doctors in the medical field, and really, they're doing their part because we need to do our part in order for them to do their part, right? So you need to take responsibility, and if you tell your doctor, I truly want to do this, monitor me, take me off as possible, you know, then most times lately they're willing to work with you. There are some, of course, that will think you're crazy and say, who did you listen to? What quack did you hear at that camp? Significantly more brain atrophy occurred in the hypertensive subjects compared to those with normal blood pressure. Well, you've heard the saying, you don't use it, you lose it, right? And slowly the brain will actually shrink from high blood pressure as well. Of course, we know to watch your salt intake if you have high blood pressure. It is used in a lot of foods as a preservative as well as an appetite-type stimulant. Again, we tend to take in 3 to 4 times the amount of what's required. But if you are using a salt, one of the best salts to use are either Celtic or Celtic sea salt, however you want to say it, and a Himalayan salt. One of these salts are your better choices. They're not refined, they're high in the minerals still, and because they haven't been processed, their potency is super high that you can almost get away with half the amount. They are quite, they're moist, so you want to put them in a jar and keep them from drying out. And, you know, just be careful. Regular sea salts as well can be really refined. Many of them are refined and bleached and the whole ordeal the same as any other table salt. So you want to make sure you're getting one that is more pure. Okay, we'll move on. So again, look at these factors contributing to high blood pressure, hypertension. What do you recognize when I've shown you different over the days? Factors that contribute to heart disease. Now I've shown you today, high blood pressure. What about in the past? Diabetes and so forth. Do you notice these factors are all somewhat similar, don't you? So again, you know, changing your diet and lifestyle. It sounds like a one-all cure-all, and it truly is. You give your body what it needs. It knows how to heal. It also knows how to prevent. Okay, I'm just going to be flipping through some of these because we don't have time. And I want to get into natural remedies, just a few natural remedies. So we will hand out our handouts now. And I want to share with you, you know, when you get into some of these, yes, thanks, some of these natural remedies, you know, we will teach, for example, hydrotherapy and so forth. And a lot of them can be almost overwhelming to a point that they're interesting, but as soon as you leave, you forget how to do it. Even if you have your notes, it kind of blows your mind away. I don't like to teach that. I want to teach some simple remedies that you can take home and literally try and be, you know, find some very positive outcomes to it. And so these are a couple I'm sharing with you today. There's 6 different ones that I especially like and find very helpful. And I'll discuss some of them as we work through. But the natural remedies, the benefits of them are that they're cheap, they're inexpensive, right? They're ready available, they're simple. You don't need a great education. You don't need a PhD to do this, right? Anybody can do this. You treat the cause and not the symptoms. Positive side effects to it. So let's work through a few of them. The first one I'll discuss is hydrotherapy itself. So with hydrotherapy, meaning to use water, whether it's in the form of water, ice, or steam, is considered hydrotherapy. It is the most powerful, non-poisonous means of quickly moving the nourishing, healing blood into and out of the diseased body part. It has been used for many, many years. I mean, if you look back over history, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Romans, they all used this treatment. And then what about the big flu in 1918 in the U.S.? Thousands of people died, but there was a group that did hydrotherapy and they survived. Hydrotherapy was the survival of that flu. So how does it work? Well, you're using hot and you're using cold, okay? So heat, what it does, this is your normal vessel right here, and with heat, it dilates it up to 40%, and it'll pull then the congestion and the impurities to the surface, entering then the bloodstream, and then it sends it into the internal organs such as your liver and your kidneys and so forth to be able to clean it. It dramatically then increases the germ-fighting white blood cells to fight that bacterial or virus, and adds nutrients and oxygen. And we know oxygen heals as well, right? Now, what about suddenly we add the cold, and what happens is it vasoconstricts, right? It constricts this blood vessel and squeezes all that blood loaded with this disease and waste too, then pushing it through to those organs, which I have just mentioned, and then the organs are able to cleanse it. So it's like this pumping effect. It expands, pulls in all the toxins, and then pumps it away. So it's this pumping reaction is what happens. So for example, many people do the hot foot bath, and the feet are your biggest pumps for the entire body. So a foot bath will even affect the tip of your head. If somebody is having a headache, they can do the foot bath and it'll help take away headache. Now on here I have for you number 3 is the outline how to do a foot bath. So for this one, you want to go to the hot for 3 minutes and then the cold for 30 seconds and you do it back and forth. Now if you have a stubborn headache, almost a migraine, you can actually take a lemon. Remember, we've talked about the power of a lemon now. You can take a lemon rind and just lay it on the forehead with a cloth, and that will actually help even more so in taking away that headache or migraine. Now we have to use caution when we're doing this type of a treatment if somebody is diabetic and doesn't have a whole lot of feeling in their feet, because they can burn themselves really easily. So you can either get somebody to help you with it to make sure you don't go beyond what you should, or there's something else that's above it called the salt glow. And the salt glow is really excellent. It works well by rubbing the skin, and you make it wet and you just rub the salt on really good till it's pink and it takes off the dead skin. It stimulates circulation. And what happens to this as well, it stimulates or increases that vasodilation without heating or cooling. And that works really good for people who can't stand the cold. Sometimes their adrenal glands are so underactive that they're just freezing and you can't even begin to do those treatments. But that salt will work. And if a person's not diabetic again, you could put their feet in some warm water and give them this salt rub down. And it'll just really start to get the adrenals going and make things, yeah. So that's another option you can try. Okay, so here we have the hot foot bath. Again, what is it doing? It's increasing the blood flow because it's opening those arteries, those veins. It decreases muscle spasm and pain, and it decreases stiffness in arthritis. Anyone who has arthritis knows that warmth is okay, but as soon as it turns cold, it can cause a lot of pain and stiffness. So you can relate to that. So then in that case, the cold is not ideal. You've heard of the paraffin wax, where people put their hand in if they have arthritis and back and forth into this wax. And what that does is conceals that heat straight into those joints, which is excellent for arthritis. Here it decreases muscle spasm and pain. Well, do you see the heat decreases muscle spasm and pain too, doesn't it? It really depends on the situation. If it is a tight muscle, then the heat is something you would want. Cold would actually make it tighten up more so. Unless you're going back and forth for that heat and cold, they can both decrease the muscle spasm and pain when you're going back and forth idea. But otherwise, heat to first relax it. But if you have actual where you've injured a certain condition, you may want cold on that to get the swelling down, not actual heat at that point. And then it decreases the blood flow because this is where now it's filled with the blood and it's going to decrease by pushing all that bad blood out, right? Sorry? What kind of salt? You know, any salt actually works. any salt works, but a lot of times I like the more coarse salt even works well. And you can get into different bath salts where you even add your own little, you know, oils to it and make it really nice too. So, but any salt can work, yes. The 12-minute ice massage. I haven't really done, explain maybe, for the actual muscles you're saying? For the that's where it's swollen, right? Rub it first. And then heat. No heat, just that. And you end with that. You know, it's interesting, I've had a few cases with even hernia, and you just use the ice and you do that rubbing for a while, and then you put some heat on it. So what's happening is you're tightening. So first you relax that muscle, and then you do the ice, so it eventually pulls itself back into place. And so you can do that with the heat and the ice and then the heat. But I haven't, I'll have to check into that one. Peripheral pumping heart here. So when a client receives a hot cold treatment to the feet and legs, as I mentioned, the feet are the main pumps for the whole body. And it'll pump the heart because it creates a pumping action to better return blood to the heart and increase that circulation completely. So a heating compress. The heating compress. Now if you look on your outline here to number 5, and the throat compress is probably the most common one that most people have done. How many of you grew up where your mom would put a sock around your neck? And there's a number of you. And you know what's interesting? Over the years, we've kind of gotten out of that, haven't we? It worked well then, but how come we don't do it now? So let me show you. It's interesting with the heating compress. A lot of times we would put that wool sock on though, right? We'd rub it with Vicks or something in the wool sock. But you actually want a cold compress first. So you want to get like a cotton sock. It's hard to find 100% cotton. Sometimes it has some polyester in it. And, you know, just get as least polyester as possible, because sometimes it's just this fancy design on it that's the polyester. But the majority of the sock is cotton. So you want to put it under really cold water, as cold as you can make it, and get it really wet, and then just wring it out as hard as you can until it's just damp. And then you're going to take this sock that's damp, and you can wrap it from the front or the back, like so. So you might go like this, and then just kind of overlap it. Or you can do it the other way and overlap it in the back. And then right away, at that point, you're kind of going, and you take a nice wool sock, and you put it around on top of that cold, wet one, and then use a pin. Let me see if we can get this. And then again, overlap it. And then just pin it and keep it that way for at least a good 4 hours. Some people choose to do that while they sleep at night, but even for, you know, 4 hours during the day, 2 to 4 hours. Now, if you sleep through the night, slowly it's going to kind of cool down. And by morning when you take it off, it's pretty much room temperature. But if you're going to do that every 2 to 4 hours during the day, you want to actually remove it and take a really cold cloth and just rub the skin, so that you can close those pores off. And then just kind of rub it until it's a little pink, and then close that off. And then you can do it again every so often through the day. Now, why is this good? Well, the cold compress is applied and covered then, that there occurs an initial cooling first, which lasts about 5 minutes, and then followed by warming up, and then that increases the circulation. So you'll start here, it drops with the initial cooling, and then it actually warms way up and then tapers off again. And this works really good for any types of heating compresses. So I just showed you for your throat. You can do it for chest, for coughs. You can do it for joint injuries type thing, your feet even. But the feet is probably one of my very favorite ones to do. And if you look at number 6, this is excellent if anyone has swelling in their feet and legs, edema, that type of thing, pain in your feet. You know, I've done this when I've been on my feet, let's say, all day in dress shoes or something, presenting all day and walking lots and this and this. Sometimes your feet can throb at the end of that night. This works excellent. You take, again, your same socks, make them really cold, wring it out, and put that on your foot. And I mean on your feet, it's really cold, right? And then right away, get a bread bag. It doesn't matter what kind of a bread bag you get one, and put your foot in it over that cold. And it seems kind of odd at first. And then you take your wool sock and you put over top of that. And actually, it's very comfortable. Once you put on your wool sock, you don't feel these others. It just warms it right up. But you will be amazed. By morning, your feet will feel so good. I had a lady who, again, was one of my students who had done this, and she had edema and swelling and pain for about 20 years, and she decided to try it. She was so excited. She's showing everyone, look, look at my feet. I can see my ankles. I haven't seen my ankles in years. So it's really worth it, you know. And sometimes in the heat, you can get swelling as well, so it's helpful for that. Which, by the way, remember, potassium plays a big role in that. If the heat and you get swelling in your feet and your ankles, drink some mint tea, and that'll help as well. But those, you know, these socks and sleeping through the night, if you find, you know, partway through the night, starts to get annoying and kind of tight and you're kind of tired of them, pull them off, and that's fine. You'll still get the benefit because it's already kind of at that point that it's done that heat, and then, you know, it's tapering off. So pull it off towards morning if you'd like. But give it a try. You will be amazed at the effects of it. Yes, mint tea has the highest source of potassium, and it is ideal for people with heat stroke, you know, or heat exhaustion, I shall say. And within 20 minutes, it's amazing. A person can be up and walking around if drinking mint tea. So I do recommend for people when you've had a day out in the heat working the garden or in the sun, come in and just have a cup of mint tea to replace that potassium you've lost. And it works wonderful. You can do the same for the feet, but the issue with the feet is usually we go to bed with it on and sleep. And so by the time we take it off, it's already closed the pores. It's come to a point of room temperature. But you could. Yeah, so either way. Okay, let's explain a little more here. So what about a hot tub? Does anyone enjoy having a hot tub and relaxing in it? Hot tubs are very beneficial as well. The main thing to remember is when you do get out of them, give yourself a light, coolish shower to, again, close those pores. Okay, but look at all the benefits of soaking in some nice warm water again. And so a lot of cases, relieving pain, stiffness, and fatigue. And that works well. I know for me, when I'm under stress, I tend to carry, I think I mentioned this on my exercise day with the stretching, but I carry it, my stress in my neck and my shoulders. And it can come to a point once in a while, if I'm under a very, you know, stressful situation, that it'll push on a nerve and I can go into a serious dizzy spell that'll last me 2 days where I can hardly even move my head a half an inch without vomiting. Like, it just spirals me. And I've learned that it's completely a muscle on one side or the other that just tightens up and does this to me. Well, one of my greatest nightmares came true when I'm thinking, what if I travel and I'm to speak and I end up this way? But it's funny, speaking actually relaxes me. But I went on this trip and I was way down south, and all of a sudden it struck me really hard. And I spent the night in bed just trying to get over this, and by morning, sometimes you sleep it off and it gets better. Morning, I woke up and I still could hardly move my head. Well, I was staying in a hotel that happened to have a hot pool. So I went down to this hot pool with help and got there and laid in it and started doing my stretches in this hot pool. And within 5 minutes, I was feeling better. I could sit up and not feel nauseous. I could tell that things, my head still wasn't quite attached to my body, but it was there at least. And from there, once I was feeling pretty good, I went into the cold pool and started swimming some laps. And you know, it left me that fast. I got out of the pool and never felt so good and had no more problems, and haven't since. It's been a couple of months. So it's amazing what heat and cold can do for a person. So if you don't have that hot pool, you know, cold pool effect, do the hot, you know, some type of hot, like those magic bags or something like that, and then some of the coolness to make that difference. Other treatments, using hydrotherapy, you can have the hot cold shower. This is probably the one I recommend for everyone to do all the time, and it's outlined for you there in number one. So you would get into your shower, do your normal shower, wash your hair, and then you would turn your water to a point that is quite warm. You can feel fairly hot, and I've given you a temperature of about 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Be careful with this. I am not saying hot to a point of pain or discomfort, just a point that you know you're fairly warm. You know how you're like, huh, that's hot, right? So then you turn it to cool, And again, I don't want you to turn it to ice cold that's going to jolt you and give you an instant heart attack. The temperature I've given you there is 75 degrees Fahrenheit. Does that sound cold? No, but when you're coming from 104 to 75, it's cold. But that's the direction I want you to go. I don't want you to crank it all the way, scream, and then put it the other way again. That's really not healthy, okay? So you want it to about 104, then 75, and then back to 104 kind of thing. I had a lady I met here in Alberta at one of my workshops I did, and she was telling me how she had been to one of our sanitariums and they taught this, and she actually came back with welts on her shoulders and her back, and they were burnt welts. And I said, how did that happen? And she said, well, I did the shower treatment. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I turned it to really hot and I just stood and grinned and bared it as long as I could, and then I put it to really cold, and then I did it again, and she actually had these burnt welts. So I can't help but emphasize now more so to be very careful. And when I'm saying hot and cold showers, I'm not saying, you know, you understand, right? So go by those temperatures that I have given you there. But this will actually boost your immune system. If you do this on a regular basis, this will protect you from getting sick. All right, let's move on. Oh, and this is fun, the sinus treatment. I won't spend time really talking about it here, but it's on your paper to try, and it's surely something different. I've done this with my students too, and it's interesting. You have actually this snorkel, and you're going into the hot water and then into the cold water, and you put some salt into your water as well. But if someone is really congested, whether it be allergies or whatever, it literally drains and just pours out. So you've got to have a Kleenex box handy. But going back and forth, and you do need somebody to help you to kind of keep adding to the hot and adding ice cubes to keep making it a little bit colder. So each time it gets a little warmer and a little colder, and get somebody to help you do that. But that will just drain and clear out those sinuses unbelievably. And you actually, if you can get a snorkel, you stick a snorkel in so that you can breathe while you're in that water. And you just kind of go back and forth. It's interesting to try. Okay, moving on. Has anyone heard of an infrared sauna? Has anyone tried those? Yes. This is another excellent source of building the immune system, and works similar with heat the same way. Basically, it works on far infrared light waves penetrating the skin, generating the natural, wonderful warmth of the sun without being in the direct sunlight all the time. It penetrates organic substances such as the human body, and it goes down 2 to 3 inches below our skin surface. And this is where all your toxins and such are and reside. So that's why it works so well as a cleansing effect. Ideally, they'll say to go up to about 150 degrees for 30 minutes. But you've got to adjust this according to the person in the situation. The nice thing about this is it does not use steam. It kills bacteria and virus, so you really don't even have to worry about cleaning this really well, because it will kill all those germs. You could sit in here and read a book because you don't have that steam. So you can take things in there, and the difference is you will sweat in this. You know, I'm not a sweater. I can exercise for, you know, 40 minutes, 60 minutes, and towards the end I'll begin to sweat more so. But I've never been a sweater in my life. And I go in here and sweat. I mean, literally, I've never seen a person walk out of there without it just dripping off of you. And every part of your body sweats. Like, you know, your arm, everything sweats. And it's a wonderful, you can just feel the detoxification of it. It reduces stress, so it will loosen your muscles and relax the body. Oh, and the thing with the steam is some people don't like steam rooms because you can almost feel claustrophobic with that steam. And you don't have that effect here, which is nice. It improves the skin, the blood circulation, expels impurities, and removes dead cells from the surface of our skin. So your complexion, the color, all that is nicer. Expulsion of toxins. So look at this. Sodium, alcohol, nicotine, all these type of things, but even carcinogenic heavy metals. So your cadmium, your lead, your zinc, your nickel, these are stored in the fat of your body. And at this temperature, your fat actually becomes a liquid that it, when you're perspiring it, you lose these. It's one way of being able to get rid of the heavy metals. Some ask me, what about mercury that's accumulated in the body? Again, infrared heat will stimulate your sweat glands to cleanse and detoxify even mercury. It's excellent for pain relief. Again, it'll expand those blood vessels, right? Increase circulation. Effective blood circulation enables more oxygen to reach the injured areas of the body and assists in reducing pain as well as speed up the healing process. Weight control. This is interesting. You perspire, of course, as I mentioned, and it's part of the process of the body, increasing your heart rate then, cardiac output, and metabolic rate. So this requires a large amount of energy and will reduce excess moisture such as salt and this fat. Fat becomes soluble, as I said, at 42 degrees when the body sweats. So it sweats out the fats and the toxins. So that's one way of getting rid of the excess fat. But look at this with the exercise. It can provide the same as some exercise. So the heart receives a similar workout and the body perspires the same amount during a 20 to 30 minute sauna session as it would if you did an 8-kilometer run. Isn't that something? Infrared saunas are ideal for those who suffer from injuries that have a hard time doing rigorous activities. So I'm not saying do this though instead of exercise, because you know the benefits. We all still need exercise, but this is a bonus, right? Again, it'll strengthen your body's immune system, even during a fever. So during a fever, this is what happens. So the infrared sauna is like inducing a fever in your body is what it does. And what happens is the body heats up and is able to eliminate viruses and attack the foreign agents. All right, do you know this man? Everyone's heard of this name before. He is the father of medicine is what they call him. And he says, give me the power to create a fever and I will heal any disease. That is exactly the situation, because it stimulates your immune system to heal. Through heat and such, we can and the whole hydrotherapy idea, you're able to increase your red blood cells by 20 to 35%. You can increase your white blood cells by 200 to 300%. Isn't that huge? And your hemoglobin by 5%. So I apologize for this. I fixed this morning, and because I dared go in and fix my program, it froze on me and it refused to open this afternoon. And fortunately, I had this on a backup. But it's already giving me a warning sign that when I'm done this today, I think it's lost again. So good thing this is last class, but hopefully you can read this. This is macrophages, which basically your immune system, okay, reaches out to engulf a bacteria with a cellular extension, which is known as a pseudopod, which is a phagocytosis process. So it reaches out and tries to envelop and engulf that bacteria. So this is it, the phagocytosis, otherwise known as cell eating. So these macrophages come and they grab it and they kind of consume it. Here you can see these killer T cells, and killer T cells will actually go and attack a cell that has a virus or bacteria in it, and it'll break it open and kill it before it even has chance to spew out and spread. So by doing the hydrotherapy, like those cold hot showers that I just mentioned, it'll kill those cells that have engulfed those bacteria and virus. It'll kill that before it has a chance to grasp hold on your system. So here it is, the T cells, supposed to say closing in on a cancer cell. So this is the cancer cell. Here's all your T cells coming in, and now they're attacking it. So you can see it's kind of flattened out there, and they're just attacking it. And this is the cancer cell, and here it is. They've killed this cancer cell. It's dead. And here's the live killer T cell still there working on your behalf. Isn't that neat? It's really amazing what our bodies do. Hey, how God put it together. It's very, very particular. Nothing boring about it. Yes, you know, that is good too, but I am told that the infrared actually penetrates your skin to that depth that it needs to be, and that's why it expels so many toxins. The other saunas make you sweat, which helps you excrete toxins, but because this goes down into the tissue at that depth, It helps to remove those toxins and melt the fat and this type of thing, and getting rid of more of those heavy metals. What did I say? I just went blind or blank. What was it? Do you remember? 2 to 3 centimeters? Inches? I was going to say inches, but it didn't sound right. Where was it? Here. It should be on here. There we are. 2 to 3 inches. It is inches. Just didn't sound right. So 2 to 3 inches so that the warming effect is yes. Okay, let's move on now to aloe vera. How many of you would think of that as a natural product? Again, very popular in the past, kind of lost its interest. It contains over 140 substances. If you look here, it is antiseptic, antiviral, anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, antifungal, and antibiotic. Wow, huh? Look at this. It produces at least 6 antiseptic agents, contains at least 3 anti-inflammatory fatty acids. Basically, it's an immune stimulator. Look at all the nutrients it has, including what? B12 and B17. Isn't that interesting? Have you ever eaten aloe vera as it is, as a plant? Is it bitter? Does it have a bitter taste? Depends on the plant. Right. Then it's okay. That's right. But that bitterness, if you ate the whole as it is, that bitterness is your laetrile. Laetrile is bitter. Amino acids, 9 of the 10 essential ones. It's lacking the tryptophan. Other minerals, look at all these minerals, calcium, copper, iron, phosphorus, potassium, zinc, chromium, and more. Enzymes, works against troubling pathogens. Look at those ones, yeast, E. coli, the most common ones. Here's all the different uses. Now, probably the most popular for burns and scalds and sunburn, right? Those are the ones that we tend to use it for. But look at all the other ones here as well. How many would think digestive problems? It's very healing to the stomach and the intestinal tract. Crohn's disease for that reason. Hemorrhoids, even stretch marks. And there's something over here I was going to say as well. Ulcerations. Let me show you, I'll show you a couple of samples of that. It is a scar inhibitor, so that's why it works so well for stretch marks as the example. A growth stimulator, that's why we know that it works well for cuts and burns, because it'll stimulate the actual growth. Yes. Yes, you can actually take your plant, that's right, and cut it and rub it on. Okay, or if you want to ingest it, of course you can buy the gels for the topical application that's been sterilized and such. You can buy juice that's been, you know, processed and sterilized to drink internally. Or you can take the actual plant, if you're not afraid of it not being sterilized, and you can blend it up in a blender with a smoothie and have it that way too. You can do the whole thing as long as your blender blends out the harder parts easy enough. And so here it is, a German pharmacist, he calls it a wound hormone. In simple terms, it accelerates the healing of the injured surfaces. So here's a couple of examples for you. This man here, he had ulceration, and after using aloe vera after 1 week, this is what it looks like. So it's already starting to heal somewhat. After 3 weeks, this is it here. Here's 5 weeks, it's almost completely healed. So we assume at about 6 weeks he was healed, and here's 8 weeks. It's totally healed. Just the pigmentation coloring of his skin is growing back in. Isn't that something? Here's a man that had radiation burns. Very sad. Look at that. Last day of radiation. Look at that effect. 10 days after, this is him using aloe vera. This is 20 days later. Isn't that something? How about a leg ulcer? I know, yuck, huh? So here we are prior to treatment. This ulcer has been going and going and causing issues. Cannot be healed any longer. Eventually, chances are he may end up with leg amputation. They decide to try some just aloe vera, okay? After 2 weeks, look what happens. You see all this redness and inflammation, how much it has gone? Here the leg is just swollen up that whole picture, and look at the inflammation gone. This one, ulcer, after 3 months, look at that area now. No more hole, it's closing in, it's healing. And this is after 7 months, it is totally healed. It's just scar tissue now that's being hopefully reverse, because this ulcer here has been a long time. It's done a lot of damage, not just the ulcer, but around it as well, as far as scar tissue goes pretty deep. But again, you know, the power of aloe vera. So how much can you take? What if you take too much? Well, studies show the only way you can kill a rat with aloe vera is to drown him in it. So how about garlic? Garlic is a natural remedy again. We know that taking garlic can help lower blood pressure. You know, you can take a clove of garlic and put it in the ear to help pull out the poisons to help with ear infection. There's lots of uses for garlic. And it is an antibiotic. So again, when people get colds or flus or this type of thing, taking garlic will help to boost the immune system. We know it's antifungal, antibacterial, anti-yeast as well. So people who have candida yeast need to do garlic to help kill off that yeast. Not only does it lower blood pressure, but you can see it also helps with cholesterol and triglycerides. Sorry, this is dark once again. But how does garlic work? The same way now, in the way of activating in some way those killer T cells. Basically, anytime you raise your immune system, more T cells are going to go out on your defense. It is a powerful detoxifier, facilitating elimination of even mercury from the body. So again, if people have concerns about mercury, garlic is another route to go. And you can eat 2 to 3 cloves a day or take 3 capsules twice a day if you're doing it, you know, medicinally. Now, garlic, some people have said, oh, you shouldn't take too much because it works like an antibiotic and your body will become immune to it. I don't believe that's true. I haven't seen that case. I haven't even seen any studies that have shown that at this point. Perhaps if you're doing a lot of supplements, eventually your body may. I'm not sure. I haven't seen that. I've had people who have used it for high blood pressure for years and still respond just as good as they did the first day. In a food form, I don't believe your body will ever work up an intolerance to it if it's in a food form. So, and I'm sure you're not going to be eating more than 3 cloves a day anyways, usually, on a regular basis. Activated charcoal. Let's quickly touch on this one. It's called the miracle of, do you see this word? Adsorption. It's not absorption, it's adsorption. So it works similar in the way, though, it works like a magnet. So it actually clings to this magnet. Whereas absorption is like a sponge that fills up with water and then you squeeze that out, right? But so it'll cling all these toxins and poisons and carry it out of the body. So here it is, the amazing absorption. Wow, the birds in the afternoon really get tangled. It just gets worse. 1 quart of activated charcoal can absorb 80 quarts of ammonia gas. So this is between 500 to 2,000 square meters to the gram. So it's enough for the internal surface area to completely cover several football fields. So you can see the potency of it. Now there's different charcoal sources. Not all charcoal is the same. What does activated charcoal mean? It means it's been put under the proper situation to make it activated. So wood is one thing. Again, so under the certain heat and certain temperature and certain time frame. Lignite, coal, animal byproducts such as bone. So these are your 3 sources of charcoal that can be beneficial. I have like 3 minutes to finish, so then I'll answer questions, I promise. Unsafe sources would be briquettes for grilling, right? So you don't want to use those. What about scorched food? No. Looks like burnt offerings, but really not, right? Unsafe sources, burnt toast, another one. These types of charcoal will actually induce cancer. They become carcinogens, so you don't want those. Barbecued meat. Now, when you're using charcoal with meat products, it contains benzopyrene. And, you know, you've seen these restaurants that advertise charcoal broiled steak, and people kind of flock to that because it's a nice taste. Well, it won't taste so sweet anymore. You ready? Benzopyrene in a 2 pound of charcoal broiled steak is equivalent to if you smoke 600 cigarettes. Do you see the power, like the carcinogen in that, in a charcoal broiled steak? So the risk is very high. This is not what you want. Wrong kind of charcoal. This man here is probably who made charcoal so famous. He wanted to test it out. And so what he was a pharmacist again, and what he did is he actually swallowed 15 grams of strychnine, which is 10 times the lethal dose. I don't recommend it for anyone. He's done it for you already. At the same time, he took an equal amount of charcoal, approximately only 3 tablespoons of charcoal, and he lived to tell the story. And it was his experiment that has really kind of pushed the charcoal to show how powerful that it is. So you want it to be a pure carbon source. It does not impart anything to body, simply takes away the poisons. And there are no known side effects. The rule of thumb when you administer charcoal is give too much, not too little. Because it's not going to make you sick, so make sure you give enough. Okay, so does charcoal interfere with digestion? We used to say yes. They would say that it would pull nutrients and minerals out of your body, and I used to teach that. But again, studies have been shown it does not. And these are a number of the nutrients they have tested, and it has no effect on it. How to use it? In 8 ounces of water, you would use 1 tablespoon of powder, or 4 capsules, or 8 tablets. Okay, food tends to interfere with the absorption by 50% reduction when the stomach is full, so on an empty stomach is better. When taking medication, try to do it 2 hours before or 2 hours after so it does not absorb your medication. External use? I can go back and leave it on that slide for you after. Do not place over a fresh or open wound due to possible tattooing. It will not hurt the wound, it'll still heal it, but you will have a black mark that stays with you and it'll look like a birthmark because it'll be with you till forever. Okay, and then there's compresses you can do as well and how to do that for poisonous bites. So what I do is, one of the things I like to do is take charcoal, add a little bit of water to it to make it a paste. Sometimes I like to add a little tea tree oil to that as well. And I will put it onto a Band-Aid. You open a Band-Aid and just put it on and then close it and do a few of those and put it into like a little pill container or a film canister. And if someone gets a bee sting or a spider bite or something, you right away have it ready. You just open that up, put a drop of water or a fresh tea tree oil drop on it, put it on, and within minutes the stinging is gone and it's pulling the poison out. There's so much benefits to charcoal. I wish I could share more, but I know time is at an end, so I don't want to hold up supper here, so we'll have our closing prayer.